Now playing Open Floor.
This is Open Floor.
Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix back at it.
An NBA podcast with Sports Illustrated senior writer.
I think it's time that the world get to know
my guy Chris Mannix.
I think your opinion is shared by everyone.
And now it begins.
Bang!
This is the Open Floor NBA podcast where we talk about the league and everything going on with it. And this week there is stuff going on in the NBA, or at least with NBA players, that spans multiple continents. Here in the U.S., you've still got some transactions moving around. Summer League wrapping up and over. In Europe, the NBA-filled Olympic roster is trying to avoid disaster, basically, after two rough games that finished off their exhibition season. Talk about that. I want to bring in a good friend of the podcast, Mark Medina. Does a great job with Sports Keita, the Sporting Tribune, Fox Sports Radio. You can see him everywhere. Longtime NBA reporter. And Mark, we're kind of going to bounce all over the place here because we got to at least touch on at the top of the show the news involving the NBA broadcast deal, which has taken yet another twist. This seemingly never-ending, you know, broadcast negotiations, which has spanned well over a year as the NBA is trying to figure out where their future home for the next 7-8 years of their, or I guess 10 years of their broadcast rights are going to be. We've known for some time that ESPN, ABC was going to retain its rights. We've known for some time that NBC was going to get in on the action with a broadcast slash streaming deal. And we have known that the NBA has wanted to be partners with Amazon on a new deal. But we also knew that Turner, which is the longtime, four-decade-long broadcast partner of the NBA, had some kind of matching rights to one or more of those deals. The news on Monday was that Turner Sports has announced that they will be matching one of these NBA broadcast rights deals offers. If that makes any sense. It has been reported that it is the Amazon offer, which is $1.8 billion per year. It's also been widely reported the NBA doesn't really want anything to do with Turner anymore. I mean, it's quite as simple as that. The NBA, they've got ESPN. They've got two broadcast outlets in ABC and NBC. And now they want the biggest streaming giant out there. They want Amazon, which has done a fantastic job with the NFL in the short time that it's had that, and it's proven itself to be a real player in sports broadcasting. Turner believes it has the right to match, and now here we are with the NBA kind of figuring out what its next move is going to be. So what do you think of this? Get any sense that Turner's going to be successful here? Do you think this is going to be a protracted fight? What's your read in the situation?
Well, there's a few reads, Chris. I think, undoubtedly, it clearly establishes that NBC and ABC, ESPN, they're the primary players with the NBA moving forward. And so that is a clear distinction from what it had been in the past, that Turner Sports was part of that. So whether Turner is still involved with this, as you mentioned, they have matching rights, but it's also from my understanding, and I'm not a lawyer and all that, but it's my understanding that the NBA also has rights to refuse that in at least some version.
NBA thinks so.
Yes. So I don't think it's going to get a litigation because that would just be a bad look for everyone involved. But I think that there still is a lot of things to sort out. It's not just a matter of, hey, Warner Brothers Discovery, Turner matched and end of story. There's still now negotiations that they have to go through back and forth. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not, Mark, it's not a restricted free agent contract, basically. Like, exactly. It's not like we matched and now it's over. There's exactly. Still very much more to play out.
Exactly. And so from here on out, it's hard for me to project what the sausage making process is going to look like. But I do think that the end result is going to be that inside the NBA is going to still exist in some form with the same cast of characters that we all know and love, with Ernie Johnson, Charles Barkley, Kenny Smith and Shaq. It's just a matter of how will it be spun off? Will it still be technically part of Turner, or can it be shared with Amazon, or a mix of both? But I think that outside of that, I can't see that Warner's having a heavy involvement other than you know, they might have rights to certain games, but even at this point in time, it's already established NBC, Disney with ESPN, they're going to be the main players showcasing, you know, the main tentpole events.
Yeah, there's no, my opinion, there's no scenario where this ends with Turner having that Amazon deal. The NBA has decided they want to be in bed with Amazon. It got contentious for a little while between the NBA and Turner. You saw, you know, David Zaslav, who runs Warner Brothers Discovery, at times he's appeared ambivalent towards the NBA. At times he's suggested they wanted it. You know, when I saw Warner Brothers going on this spending spree, you know, over the last few months, you know, getting tennis rights and golf rights and college football rights, it made me kind of assume that they were just going to walk away from this. I think there's a method to the madness with Turner. I think they know they're not going to get that Amazon package, but maybe they're out for something else. Maybe there is some kind of fourth package that can be negotiated between the NBA and Warner Brothers. I'm skeptical, but maybe that's what they're looking out for. I think by matching this offer, Warner Brothers gives itself some options here. It at least puts them in play and delays what's probably inevitable, which is Amazon getting that big package. So I don't know what the timeline for all this is. It could be a few days. It could be a few weeks. But ultimately, I think we're going to land exactly where we are with ESPN, ABC, NBC, Peacock, and Amazon having all these rights. And hopefully we're not talking about broadcast stuff again for another decade. So let's talk for a minute about Summer League, which just officially wrapped in Las Vegas. Congratulations to the Miami Heat. You are the Summer League champions, and the nice ring that goes with that. You got to spend, what, 2 weeks? How long was it? Almost 2 weeks in Vegas, 10 days in Vegas. That's a long time in Vegas. And you become the champions. But like the story at Summer League, whether people care or not, and they do care based on web traffic and, you know, YouTube metrics, but the story in Summer League is Bronny James and what he looked like. It was a very bad start for Bronny James, both at the California Classic and in Vegas. He started off shooting in the 20s from the field. He missed his first, 15 threes. He was 0 for 15 going into last Wednesday's game against Atlanta. And he looked overwhelmed. He looked completely overwhelmed. The next two games looked pretty good. Had 12 points the next game. I think it was at 15 or something. The game after that, started to settle into his game a little bit there. I know you're out in Vegas briefly, covering all that. Give me your takeaway of, you know, the Bronny project kind of getting underway.
Yeah, well, you outlined it pretty well, but I think what really jumped out to me from the beginning was, you know, the atmosphere. You mentioned the web metrics. The arena metrics also showed that they cared about Bronny. I mean, it was a near sellout, and as soon as the Lakers' debut with Bronny ended, even though the next game was between the Atlanta Hawks and Washington Wizards, number one, number two pick, most of the arena cleared out. The first few games was awkward because you saw him missed a lot of shots. You saw the crowd have a wave of emotions of angst when he had the ball, but also urging him and trying to cheer him on to make shots. When he would finally make a shot, you know, the crowd is going wild as if he hit a game winner. But I think at the end of it, we did see some turnarounds of him, you know, obviously making more shots than he was at the beginning. He's showing his effort and hustle and resiliency. And I think that, you know, the inevitable goalposts of expectations moved, where, you know, I share Jaylen Brown's opinion. I don't think that right now Bronny James is an NBA player, but I think he can develop into an NBA player. And so I think the fact that even though he doesn't have a defined skill set and he had ups and downs, the positive intangibles of work ethic, team play, making the right play, and also the buy-in publicly and privately that, hey, if I got to play in the G League to get most of my playing time, I'm going to embrace it. All those things tilt in the right direction. And, you know, a few NBA executives outside of the Lakers, obviously they have a lot of question marks about his game. But if you're going to look for a silver lining, one person in particular told me, I don't know what his ceiling's going to be. I don't know what his defined skill set, but because he has all those positive attributes that I outlined, he had optimism that he could carve out a path for him to be an NBA role player. And obviously that's much different than what his father's legacy is going to be. But, you know, in that in and of itself can be successful. But in the short term, lots of ups and downs, which I think we all expected.
Look, he has been, by the Lakers, overvalued as a prospect. Like, he's probably not worth the multi-year guaranteed investment that the Lakers have made in him. That's not to say, though, that he's not a prospect, that he doesn't have potential to be a solid NBA player, because you do see signs of a real NBA talent. You see defensive instincts that are legitimate. You see obvious athleticism. I think his three-point shot right now is broken, but we've seen a lot of guys with broken three-pointers that eventually get it fixed during their NBA careers. So for the 55th overall pick, and I've said this multiple times, I encourage people to go through Basketball Reference and look at the 55th pick in the draft over the last 20 years and tell me which one of them have ever made. I think Etuan Moore was the last one that anything resembled a serviceable NBA career, and that was like 10, 12 years ago. For the 55th overall pick, there's enough upside to justify being on that summer league roster. I think I have two questions when it comes to Bronny. One, did he make the right decision navigating his career to the Lakers? Because that's what he did, right? Like, you know, Bronny, I remember at his opening press conference, you know, kind of did the whole, like, I'm happy to be drafted thing. But the reality is he wanted to be drafted by the Lakers. It was the Lakers and Suns as the only two teams that he worked out for. So he is, you know, willingly stepping into this fishbowl. Like, every time he's at Crypto.com Arena and in that Lakers locker room, it's going to be an event. Reporters like you and me are going to be in there. We're going to be watching his every move. Where's his locker? How much interaction does he have with LeBron? What does that interaction look like? We'll be staring down the end of the bench. Is LeBron coaching him up? Does the coaching staff put him in games? When do they put him in games? Does he take somebody else's minutes, those first minutes on the floor with his dad? Like, he is putting himself into the kind of fishbowl that was always going to exist for Bronny James, but wouldn't be this scrutinized, right? Like, if he played for San Antonio and wound up spending the year with the Austin Toros, there'd still be interest in what he was doing. There would still be a good crowd at a summer league game, but there wouldn't be the day-to-day type interest. Like, the South Bay Lakers, which is the Lakers G League affiliate, like, they play what? The UCLA Health Center, like, where the Lakers practice? I'm going to guess they're going to play at Crypto more often this year because there's going to be a bigger crowd. There's going to be more attention paid to Bronny James and how he's developing this year. So his decision and his agent Rich Paul's decision to put him in this position, that I question, right? Like, I might have been more open to, you know, an Orlando, San Antonio, really anybody else, like, outside of the Lakers and what they might be able to offer him as far as his development. The Lakers, though, it sure sounds like the Lakers have the right attitude when it comes to him. Like, you saw, like, the head coach, Dane Johnson, talking about how, you know, sort of intimating that he expects him to be in the G League for most of next year. You know, J.J. Redick, in some of the interviews he did, talked about him as a developmental player. Like, this is a kid that needs to spend every minute possible in the G League, you know, playing as far outside of all the eyeballs as you possibly can. He needs minutes. He needs reps. He does not need to be the 15th man on this roster. He needs to be playing meaningful minutes and developing in the only way that's going to give him a chance to become a legitimate NBA player. So I'm hoping that that is his season next year. You know, still living clearly in LA, but playing for the South Bay Lakers as often as he can.
Yeah, Chris, a lot of good stuff to unpack here. I mean, for someone who has no skin in the game, objectively, I think that Bronny would have been better off going another year in college.
I agree with that too.
Whether he wants to do the transfer portal because he didn't feel like USC was the right fit, they obviously went through coaching changes. That's fine, but you know, that would have been
Like, if the reports are true, he was about to go to the Midwest. Like, he was about to go to Duquesne to play there, which it's kind of the same thing like we're talking about. Like, get out of the fishbowl. Like, get out of Los Angeles. Get away from your famous father and develop kind of on your own time.
Yeah, and you're getting playing time. You're playing in games of consequence, high-stakes games. So that, you know, for all the talk about, hey, he just needs to play more. Well, that would have been the recipe for that, given, you know, his limited workload last season with coming off the cardiac arrest, just the USC depth chart in general, and because he only played his freshman year. But since he did go down this path, I do understand from a business perspective what Rich Paul and them did. They basically ensured that he got a guaranteed contract as opposed to going undrafted and being on a two-way. Now, to your point about, I think, some of the potential landmines, I think that very early on, both Bronny and the Lakers have avoided it by simply outlining that most of his time is going to be in the G League. Some of those awkward locker room dynamics with LeBron, you know, potentially awkward as far as just their interactions, playing time, that won't exist as much because most of his time is going to be in the G League. I think most of the time that he'll be with the Lakers is just training camp. And then, you know, I think that beginning of the opening month of the season, where is that overlap of when the G League season starts? But once that starts, he's going to be playing with the South Bay Lakers, and that's where he's going to get reps, playing time. And I think I do agree with the larger point that you get out of the fishbowl, smaller market, and you escape the expectations. But if the family is so insistent, both LeBron and Bronny, about playing together, I will say that the Lakers do have a good infrastructure with not just what you mentioned about Dane Johnson, J.J. Redick coaching them up, establishing expectations, but for all the, you know, shortcomings that the Lakers have had in recent seasons, one good thing that they do have is how they develop young players. Now, they might not be good with retaining young players, but they have had a good track record with both drafting young players and developing them in the G League. So from that standpoint, this can be successful. But
no, let me pause you on that. Like, wait. We're talking Austin Reeves, I'm guessing, because that was certainly a good one. Alex Caruso,
yeah,
that's another one. I'm not sure I'm buying this Laker infrastructure narrative here. I'm not know if I'm going with that. Like, the Lakers do, as you well know, have one of the smallest front offices in the NBA, smallest scouting staffs in the NBA. This is something that they have pledged to improve, you know, under J.J. Redick and under this new kind of college-like developmental program that they're trying to build. But, Mark, Oklahoma City, they are not, right? Like, they...
I'm not comparing them to Oklahoma City. Don't get me wrong here. I'm just saying, of all the misgivings that the Lakers have shown in recent years, most of it's been roster construction, you know, trade mishaps. When you rank it, this part of player development's not at the top of the list as far as their major weaknesses.
You love you some Max Christie is what you love. You are looking at Max Christie as that next guy.
Hey, get ready. He is going to be a breakout player this year with more playing time.
Let's wait and see on that one, too. Let's talk about USA basketball, which is entering the Olympics in a very interesting situation. They just completed their exhibition tour on Monday. They beat Germany in that game. Close game down the stretch. They're actually down a point with about 4 minutes to play before LeBron James went supernova again and carried them through it. Officially, Mark, they went 5-0 during this exhibition tour. They won by an average of 10 points per game. But if you look at the last two games, they won by 1 point against South Sudan. They won by, 5 points or 4 points against Germany. They're not really going into these Olympics with momentum. They do have convincing wins over two medal favorites in Canada and Serbia, so they can hang their hat on that. But the defense has kind of been hit or miss. The shooting has been hit or miss. The turnovers have been bad. Look, they play like a team that was thrown together in just a couple of weeks' time. And even though they, you know, came together months and months ago, it was just, you know, a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, that they were in training camp in Las Vegas. So, give me your state of USA basketball right now. You were in Vegas for their training camp, and when you saw them play in their exhibition game, is this what you expected, you know, going into the Olympics? A team that, you know, is still the favorite, no doubt about it, but maybe less a favorite now than they were after that game against Canada.
Yeah, there's the way I would put it, and I'll unpack it more in depth. It feels like this is a choose your own adventure type book where there's a lot of different scenarios that can happen here. I did anticipate. I mean, obviously, we all know, Chris, the international games – been a lot more competitive. You've written the definitive feature piece on South Sudan on how they've made themselves into a formidable program.
Thank you, South Sudan, for making the magazine story hold up. I appreciate you, Luol Deng, and all you folks at South Sudan.
No doubt. I did not anticipate Kevin Durant being out for this long with his left calf. Now, this Steve Kerr and USA Basketball will continue to say he's day to day. His return is imminent. He has done some individual work, but the longer he's out, the more concerns that is. And obviously, he's Kevin Durant. I mean, Ty Lue, I remember, and I think other players have since said this, but when I was at USA camp in Vegas, Ty Lue emphatically made the point, if it wasn't for Kevin Durant, like, we wouldn't have won gold in Tokyo. I mean, that's how important he is. So even when Definitely. You have LeBron James, Steph Curry, obviously a lot of great Hall of Fame, future Hall of Fame players on the team, he is that important to it. But I didn't expect that they would be barely beating South Sudan and Germany, but I also didn't expect that they would be coasting the double digit wins where, you know, every game like it was against Serbia would be the norm. I thought it'd be somewhere in between. So what that means moving forward, I still think USA is going to win gold. If they don't win gold, obviously disappointment, but I'm just of this mind, like, anything can literally happen. And while I am continuously impressed that LeBron James is doing what he's doing at this stage of his career, it also isn't a good sign that he's having to play almost the same way he's had to play for the Lakers in recent years, but with Team USA. So even though, you know, Steve Kerr's having different rotations, they've had the turnovers, Joel Embiid, I think, has shown, you know, both pluses and minuses with adjusting to the FIBA game. That shouldn't fully explain why it's as this fragile as it is, but I'm also not holding up the giant red flag saying they're not going to win gold.
I'm not holding up the red flag, but I've got it locked into the flagpole ready to pull any moment because, like, the problems they had are pretty consistent. Now, sometimes a three-point shot doesn't fall down or doesn't go down. 14 turnovers against South Sudan, 14 turnovers in 40-minute games. That's a big number against Germany. They're sloppy. Like, they don't have great chemistry. And you watch some of these international teams like Germany, the reigning world champions, South Sudan, who has a group of guys been together for a pretty long time, comparatively speaking, to the U.S., and they run offenses. Like, I'm watching the U.S., and it's a lot of high pick and roll. It's a lot of low to mid post. It's a lot of isolation. And look, that works in the NBA, but with these FIBA rules where there's no illegal defense, where you can knock the ball off the rim, you get a whole bunch of different things, it's more difficult. It's more challenging. So, look, the Durant part of it, this was billed, Mark, as a minor injury back in early camp. It was like, no big deal. Nothing to see here. I'll be back at some point. Misses the entire exhibition slate. And I was watching on ESPN, Brian Windhorst effectively ruled him out for Sunday's game against Serbia. Like, he's out there saying, like, you know, almost a week from now, Kevin Durant is not going to be ready to play. So really, best case scenario, you're dropping Durant onto a team that he's only had a handful of practices with, hasn't played in a real game with, going up against teams that are, you know, sharp and are, you know, that are good. And we've seen during these international games, like, my God, like, Dennis Schroeder is a journeyman at this point. He's been on 5 teams in the last 3 years. That is the definition of a journeyman. All of a sudden, he turns into an MVP playing in international play. Like, Evan Fournier with France couldn't get off the bench with the Knicks for 2 years. He's Steph Curry, international play. Like, these games are different. These players play differently. There's a level of passion that they play with in international basketball that doesn't exist with USA basketball. USA players want to win NBA championships. They need to win NBA championships. I don't know how much they need to win Olympic gold. Like, not as badly as some of these international teams do. And that closes the talent gap. Like, there's a huge talent gap. Like, the team from Germany, how many games would that team win in the NBA? Like, 5? Like, maybe? Like, it would get killed in the NBA. But they play with a fluidity and they play with a passion that the U.S. just had a hard time keeping up with. So, Yeah, I'm kind of at sort of yellow alert now, to borrow an old Star Trek phrase. Like, I'm kind of right there with the, you know, group play. I think they'll be okay in. I think they'll play better against the South Sudans of the world in group play. I think they'll play. They already played well against Serbia. But you get to that knockout round, Mark. I don't know, man. Like, without LeBron James, they would be entering this Olympics on a two-game losing streak. And what would we be talking about then? Like, how big a catastrophe would that be?
No, it'd be terrible. And to your point, with Kevin Durant and chemistry and how do you build a rhythm, I think the complicated part about this is I don't have any concern about how he's going to fit in. He's plug and play. He's Kevin Durant. But I have a lot of concern on what his rhythm is going to be, as well as if he's going to have another injury. And I do caution listeners, I'm not saying these are the same kind of injuries or same potential scenarios, but we all know when he came back from his calf injury in the 2019 NBA Finals, that same game, Achilles injury. And that game, you may recall, Chris, when he played, it was like he didn't miss a beat. He was Kevin effing Durant hitting every single shot, and then all of a sudden, something happened. So that's really, I think, the touchy part is to what you were saying. From the very beginning, the messaging is that this injury is minor, day-to-day, but he hasn't played any exhibition games. We know Kevin Durant's injury history since his Achilles in 2019. You know, this is, you know, I don't want to say precarious, but it does leave me concerned about what his return will look like, not from a chemistry production standpoint, but from a health standpoint.
Look, and this is a crossroads moment for USA basketball, right? Like, they were able to kind of reassemble Voltron because of, in part because LeBron, you know, got active with recruiting players last fall after the debacle of the World Championship. So they were able to put together the best they could assemble, some of the best players, most of the best players in the U.S. But moving forward, they're probably not going to be able to do that, right? Like, it's going to be challenging to put together that type of team. You know, I've seen some people on social media be like, oh, just send the Celtics, send the NBA champion. Well, if you sent the Celtics, you wouldn't get Porzingis, you wouldn't get Al Horford. Like, there'd be key players that you wouldn't have.
You'd at least get Jaylen Brown, though.
Yeah, that would eventually get Jaylen Brown there. You're right. but, like, to me, regardless of how this tournament ends, the U.S. needs to change the way it builds its national team. It needs to get, just like Jerry Colangelo did years and years ago, multi-year commitments. Like, you need to get a bunch of guys, and maybe they're not the best players in the world. Maybe you're talking about, you know, a handful of all-stars, all-star candidate types, some young players. You need to get guys participating in international games in the summer of 2025, 26, 27, all leading into the Olympics. So you can start to develop some chemistry with the players, with the coaching staff, with all that. Because just throwing a bunch of great players together does not work anymore. They might get away with it this cycle because the players are that good. And if Durant comes back, he's going to be a difference maker. But long term, it's not going to work. The world is too freaking good. South Sudan just became a country 13 years ago, and they almost beat USA basketball. Like, think about that. They've got four guys on that team that have NBA playing experience, and none of them are all-stars. So the world, it's caught up, and it's a different stage that you have to play on. I think one way or the other, they've got to change the way they build their national team moving forward.
Yeah, and there's some interesting things with this, because I agree with your point that the novelty of winning a gold medal, it's stronger with other teams. But I will say that no one with USA basketball wants to be associated with any team that doesn't win gold.
No.
You can recall the 2004 team that won, that finished with bronze. I think at this, when you look at this team in particular, obviously LeBron James, Steph Curry, and if Kevin Durant ever returns, they're the faces of the team. But I think it's safe to say this is their last Olympic run. But with exception of Kevin Durant, we haven't seen the kind of continuity that we saw with other generational stars in the past with LeBron and Steph. This is Steph's first Olympic run. He did not play in previous years, won 2016, coming off injuries in the finals. 2021, he felt like he needed to, you know, recharge and get himself healthier after that compressed post-bubble season. And that was the same thing with LeBron. So even though we've seen LeBron and Steph play really well, their potential value hasn't been as strong as it could have been, because this is literally their first time together, not only with each other, but with this respective group. I think the other point that you made as far as that continuity, we have some of those potential players in place. I think Jason Tatum and Anthony Edwards come to mind, that, you know, they are coming off of Team USA experience. Jason Tatum in particular, he's already played with the Olympics. I see them having multi-year stints in this, but I can't think of other examples.
I've seen Edwards comments from him say, like, he's down to play in the next Olympics, but not before then. And I believe I'm on steady ground here, thinking that Tatum's not going to do it either. Like, Tatum, you know, especially being on a team like Boston that is probably going to be playing deep into the, you know, late spring months for the next couple of years, I doubt he's going to want to turn around and start playing, you know, international friendlies in Serbia, or, you know, go to the World Cup in 2027. Like, I don't think he's going to do that. I think they've got to look further down the depth chart there and start looking at guys that, like, ambitiously want to be part of Team USA, that if it was open to everybody to do whatever they want, they wouldn't be part. And I'm not saying, like, I think Peyton Pritchard might be too far down the totem pole, but in that area, just get guys that want to play. 12, 15 guys, whatever it is, that want to play, few alternates, and see what you can do that way, because this is not sustainable. What they're doing is simply not sustainable on a championship level. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, to the larger point is that those were only the two potential examples. There is a short pool, not just of potential FIBA players, but also potential Olympic players. And I think that one thing to point out when you look at the 08-12 team, it's not like those headliners were playing in the FIBA World Championships in 10 and 14, but there was, to what you said, a multi-year commitment with both sides of the program, where that ensured continuity, that also ensured a feeder system for the players that did really well in 2010-14. There was a pathway for them to be on the Olympic roster. And when you're looking at the headliners as well as the second tier players, we're running out of players. And part of that's the global part of the game. You know, some of the future and current faces of the NBA, like Victor Wembanyama, Luka Doncic, Nikola Jokic, they're playing internationally. But it's also, I think, this point in time where the current faces of the NBA with LeBron and Durant and Steph, they're about to be on their way out, at least from, you know, the Olympic calendar standpoint.
You know, and guys like Giannis and Jokic and Doncic, like, they're not playing every cycle either, but Most of their teammates are, right? Like, they've got like 8 or 9 guys that are consistently part of that national team. So yeah, you've got to adapt to throwing a player like Giannis into the mix, but that's a lot easier than having 12 guys that never played together, do that. So yeah, I think for Grant Hill moving forward, regardless of what happens during these Olympics, I think there's going to be a fundamental change to how they build out that roster. All right, couple of NBA things I want to talk about before I let you go. One, the Cleveland Cavaliers have finished their offseason. They have brought back who they needed to bring back, the latest being Evan Mobley, who gets a 5-year max-level contract with the team. This is in the aftermath of them signing Donovan Mitchell to a 3-year max-level contract. So now the core of the team that went to the second round of the playoffs last year, we'll have a new coach. Kenny Atkinson is going to be coaching that team, replacing J.B. Bickerstaff. But the core of that team will be back. The question now, Mark, is should this team run it back? The argument for is that they're a whole bunch of young guys. Darius Garland's 24. Jared Allen's 26. Mobley's 23. Really, you've got most of the guys on that team are in their 20s. You've got some runway there in terms of youth. But at the same time, like, does a Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland backcourt work at a championship level? Can you get away with playing 2 7-footers in Allen and Mobley at a championship level? What say you about that? Is this the kind of team that should be given another opportunity with the same group? Or as this offseason progresses, should they be looking to do a deal that overhauls the roster?
Yeah, I mean, barring a crazy deal that's too good to pass up. I think that their best pathway is running it back, but also reevaluating as things go on. I don't necessarily agree for whatever shortcomings Bernie or JB Bickerstaff had with X's and O's. You know, I thought he got the short end of the stick here because most of their shortcomings last season had to do with health and the fact that they played the Boston Celtics in the playoffs. But that, that being be a problem. Said, yeah, that being said, Kenny Atkinson's a great hire. You know, he's very good offensive minded. He has a very good reputation when it comes to player development. So I think that even though there are a lot of fair questions when it comes to how Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland coexist, they also didn't play a lot of games together because of overlapping injuries. There's also a lot of fair questions about how Evan Mobley and Jared Allen can coexist as two bigs in the modern NBA. But I think there's a no-brainer to obviously extend Donovan Mitchell. They also obviously dodged a bullet of the potential that he didn't want to sign an extension. I also thought it was a no-brainer to sign Evan Mobley to an extension because it's a rookie extension. He's a really great defender. I think that he also has a lot of offensive potential under Kenny Atkinson. I think now the questions moving forward, I think, are twofold. The first part is to what you said. Can Evan Mobley and Jared Allen coexist? I think defensively they can. They're great big rim protectors. Can they coexist offensively? Kenny Atkinson, this press conference, mentioned that he's going to look for different ways in his playbook to make them more efficient offensively. We'll wait and see on that part. And then the second part is Darius Garland and Donovan Mitchell. I have more optimism on that chemistry offensively just because they haven't had as much time together. But I think everything's subject for evaluation. But I think at least moving forward, very good sign that they're able to commit to Donovan Mitchell and Evan Mobley. And that's what they should be doing, regardless of how well they fit with their other two players with Garland.
You know what, though? I don't love the mix overall. Like, I think it's got a low ceiling. I think that Kenny Atkinson is going to do some good things. I think he's got a well-earned reputation as a player development guy. And I think you'll see that pay dividends with Evan Mobley, who has not evolved into a shooter at this point. You know, very good defensive player, does some nice things off the dribble, but is still not an outside threat. I don't know that Mobley and Allen can coexist at a championship level. Like, I give them credit for pulling it off. Like, they effectively zigged when everybody else was zagging, you know, going to play small ball. They said, no, we're going to go big. And they basically got Jared Allen for nothing as part of that James Harden deal. But I just don't know if it works against these smaller, quicker teams that permeate the NBA. Like, I just think it's going to be challenging there. I'm even less optimistic about Mitchell and Garland. Not because of either flaws in either one of them. It's just that I think both those guys need to be playing opposite a bigger guard, right? Like, I liked when Garland was out, you saw Isaac Okoro in that mix, and I thought that made more sense. Like, that, a more physical two-man, which, you know, Mitchell would have to be more of a point guard in that scenario, but I think he can be, especially in today's NBA, where I don't know how, you know, I think he can get away with it. And same thing with Garland. Like, and he's playing next to Okoro, I think that makes more sense. Like, both these guys are really good players. It's not a knock on either one of them. It's just that I don't think two smallish guards can succeed in the NBA. Not unless you're super physical, like, you know, Derek White and Drew Holiday in Boston. Neither one of those guys are that. I know the Cavs' defensive numbers were really good, but, like, you take away that size with Mobley and Allen, and those guard deficiencies become a lot more glaring, Mark. They just do. Like, the great defense was not because of great perimeter defense by Garland and Mobley. It was because you had incredible backstops like Mobley and Jared Allen. I think, to me, somehow somebody should lock David Griffin and Kobe Altman in a room and just say, come out when you have a deal that involves Brandon Ingram going to Cleveland, right? Like, the Pelicans don't want to pay Brandon Ingram full freight. I don't blame Brandon Ingram for holding out for it, because that's what you do. But, like, you know, David Griffin himself came out and said at the end of last year that he'd seen enough, like, that there needed to be changes. And so far, really, there haven't been many changes in New Orleans at the moment. And the big change would be Brandon Ingram going elsewhere. We know they need a center in New Orleans. Jared Allen, still a high-level guy, all-star. I mean, he was a replacement, but he was an all-star. you know, good. I think he'd be good opposite Zion Williamson. If I'm the Pelicans and the Cavs, I know it's complicated because the salaries are big, but Brandon Ingram on Cleveland makes sense. Jared Allen in New Orleans makes sense. I don't know how Garland gets worked into that mix. Maybe you do another deal involving him, but to me, Cleveland, if you bring back this group, you're asking for the exact same outcome, regardless of the coaching change. You're asking for a 4 or 5 seed, maybe as high as 3 in the Eastern Conference, but then you're asking to get beat in the second round of the playoffs.
Yeah, Chris, great point. As you were talking, I was thinking, you know, the reason for me saying this is the best course is I couldn't think of specific realistic alternatives because of the second apron limitations, and let's see what happens leading to the trade deadline. But you're 100% right with the Pelicans. I mean, not just with what you said, but they got DeJounte Murray in a separate deal, and there's just even more of a logjam on how that current group right now is going to handle ball handling duties. You have Murray, CJ McCollum, Zion Williamson, and Brandon Ingram. That was a clear precursor that their intent moving forward would be to find the right deal for Brandon Ingram. So yeah, I'm with you that deal for both sides needs to happen. It'll be good for both organizations. And let's see what happens. But yeah, I think to the broader point, it was more outside of that. Couldn't think of specific scenarios that were better. But as I was mentioning, everything is now subject for evaluation on what will work, won't work between those two duos.
Oh, look, they've got a little bit of room to operate now that Mitchell is on a long-term extension. Garland's on a long-term contract. Got Mobley now on a long-term contract. So there's not a huge amount of pressure at the moment. I just look at that team and I see a good team with no real potential to be great. And look, maybe Brandon Ingram doesn't work, but on paper, it looks like he's a better fit than a guy like Darius Garland with that group right now. Last thing for you. Russell Westbrook is headed to Denver. He was waived this week by Utah after the Clippers attached a second-round pick to send him there, get Chris Dunn back in return and sign and trade. I hope there's somebody in Utah that's sending Russell Westbrook his Jazz jerseys. Like, I just hope there's somebody in that front office. That,
video tributes, too, here.
Video tributes, the whole night. Like, just have some fun with it, man. Like, welcome back, Russ. Like, you can have, like, some, you know, NBA Today clip of, like, Russell Westbrook's been traded to the Utah Jazz. Russell Westbrook's been traded to the Utah Jazz twice now in the last couple of years. He's been traded to Utah. I just hope somebody in that Danny Ainge, Justin Zanuck front office is like telling their guys, make him jerseys and send it to him.
I don't know if this was the right tone that they wanted to hit or the right notes, pun intended, but I did see at their social media account when they announced the news, they did the whole hashtag take note or take
note. Yeah, well, I mean, that's, yeah, yeah. But didn't but like, remember when Carmelo was traded to Atlanta? Didn't the Hawks make a Carmelo jersey and he was like immediately waived? Like, I think they did that. So I wish the Jazz, or hope the Jazz do something like that. But now it sounds like, by all reports, Russ is headed to Denver. And it sounds like this is because Nikola Jokic wants Russ in Denver. Russ is a polarizing guy. He had his ups and downs with the Clippers. Didn't end well. Just didn't fit with that team. Couldn't make shots in the playoffs. Do you get that? What do you make of the Nuggets and Nikola Jokic specifically wanting Russell Westbrook on that team?
Well, I think it's two things. Organizationally, I think it's because the Nuggets don't have any other better alternatives. And they need to replace some departing key rotation players with KCP and Reggie Jackson last season, losing Bruce Brown and Ish Smith. But he is, you know, well-liked among the NBA players because of his competitiveness and his pedigree. But I will say that I think that it'll be good for the regular season, but I have my doubts about the playoffs. And here's a few reasons. Like the Clippers, the Nuggets can better shield Russell Westbrook's inefficiencies and weaknesses far better than the Lakers could have because of their roster construction issues. So I think that he can be of value as long as he's coming off the bench and not thinking he's a starter, because it's better for Jamal Murray to be the point guard than Russell Westbrook to do his thing. But I think that can lead to regular season success if he is leading that second unit with just doing Russell Westbrook things, with moving the pace, being competitive, adding some juice when, you know, maybe some of their core is not feeling like they have that juice during the regular season. And also during the chances that Jamal Murray is having an injury. That's the only time that Russ should start. I think the problem that we've seen with Russ, even during his time with the Clippers, is that he can embrace things when he just put his foot in the door. But the longer time goes on, he wants to have the role and expectations that he had when he was in his prime. And as we saw in the playoffs this past season, even when Kawhi Leonard was out with his injury, Russell Westbrook wasn't reliable, and his minutes dictated that. So, yeah, I think Michael Malone, he can manage him. He's a good head coach. He knows how to, you know, prop guys up and also hold them accountable. But I think that this is just a regular season solution. It's not a playoff solution.
Well, look, to succeed in Denver, you've got to make shots playing off Nikola Jokic. Michael Porter Jr. has thrived in that. Jamal Murray playing the two-man game with Jokic has thrived with that. KCP made a lot of three-pointers playing off Nikola Jokic. I saw some stuff like Russ can shoot corner threes. Like, stats don't back that up. Like, I'm looking at Russ's numbers. Left corner three last season, 25.8%. Right corner three last season, 29.7%. Above the break threes last season, 26.7%. He's not making threes. And, like, if you're putting him out there, you know, teams are going to leave him alone. Like, they're going to let him camp out in either corner or at the top of the key and say, beat us. We'll put another defender on Jokic or on Murray or whoever and defend you that way. Like, I get what you're saying. Like, they don't have a lot of great options in terms of a backup guard who's got experience. They're going to rely heavily on young players next year. And, like, they won't be made, you know, they won't make it or break it based on Russell Westbrook, right? They'll be made or broken based on Julian Strother and Christian Brown and guys like that and Peyton Watson playing at a high level or not. But I don't see how Russell Westbrook helps them. I don't get the fit. I don't get it. Maybe Jokic loves his competitiveness. Everybody does. He is well-regarded in locker rooms. But I don't get it. I really don't. Yeah. Like, he's good in transition. Like, you know, you can give him the ball and send him on his way that way. And sure, if you want to use him as a spot starter, if you're going to keep Murray out some games to rest him or for health reasons, I get it from that perspective. But, you know, in terms of playing meaningful minutes, I don't see it. You got to be a three-point shooter. He's not a three-point shooter. That's kind of what it boils down to.
I'm with you 100%. It's all circumstances. And to your point, he's not a missing piece of the championship puzzle. He's just a nice addition. But when we're ranking outside of Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray, Michael Porter Jr., it's more about their young guys' development with Christian Brown and Peyton Watson than it is Russell Westbrook being able to rekindle the magic of his prime years. Because we've seen, even with a better roster and, you know, maybe more empowerment with the Clippers, that scenario doesn't exist. He's in a different stage in his career. And I'm amused you brought up those analytics about his corner threes. I remember during his time with the Lakers, there were numbers that suggested the same thing. Oh, he's better when he shoots from the corner three. But what the numbers really represented was he was just not as terribly, or he was just not as bad compared to other marks around three-point range, but it was still bad.
Yeah, he's sub 30 from every spot on the floor when it comes to three-pointers. The numbers don't lie. I give him credit for how he's adapted over the years, you know, becoming a sixth man and, you know, kind of embracing that role at times with the Clippers. And I do think he had some success there. But I don't get it with the Nuggets. He's going to be on a minimum contract, so they could just walk away, you know, whenever they wanted to. But I just don't see it being a difference maker in Denver. Mark, great stuff, man. Always appreciate you taking some time to join me here on the show. Check out Mark over at Sports Keita. He's got a great piece with Chris Mullen up right now. Check him out, Sporting Tribune, Fox Sports Radio as well. Mark, good stuff, man. Thanks for joining me.
Chris, great stuff on your end. Always appreciate you, man.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.